resolved itself into a plume of sand or water, ripped into the air by a fast-moving surface vehicle that was tearing around the curve of the beach toward us. "Told you she'd come." "Or someone would," I muttered, getting to my feet and reaching for the Nemex, which was, of course, not there. Not many virtual forums allowed firearms in their constructs. Instead, I brushed sand from my clothes and moved down the beach, still trying to rid myself of the brooding feeling that I was wasting my time here. The vehicle was close enough now to be visible, a dark dot at the front of the pluming wake. I could hear its engine, a shrill whine over the melancholy carping of the gulls. I turned to Ortega, who was watching the approaching craft impassively at my side. "Bit excessive for a phone call, isn't it?" I said nastily. Ortega shrugged and spun her cigarette away into the sand. "Money doesn't automatically mean taste," she said. The speeding dot became a stubby, finned, one-man ground jet, painted iridescent pink. It was plowing along through the shallow surf at the water's edge, flinging water and wet sand indiscriminately behind it. But a few hundred meters away, the pilot must have seen us, because the little craft veered out across the deeper water and cut a spray tail twice its own height toward us. "Pink?" Ortega shrugged again. The ground jet beached about 10 meters away and shuddered to a halt, ripped up gobbets of wet sand splattering down around it. When the storm of its arrival had died, a hatch was flung back, and a black-clad, helmeted figure clambered out. That the figure was a woman was abundantly clear from the form-fitting flight suit, a suit that ended in boots inlaid with curling silver tracery from heel to toe. I sighed and followed Ortega up to the craft. The woman in the flight suit jumped down into the shallow water and splashed up to meet us, tugging at the seals on her helmet. As we met, the helmet came off, and long, coppery hair spilled out over the suit's shoulders. The woman put her head back and shook out the hair, revealing a wide-boned face with large, expressive eyes the color of flecked onyx, a delicately arched nose, and a generously sculpted mouth. The old, ghostly hint of Miriam Bancroft's beauty this woman had once owned had been scrubbed out utterly. "Kovacs, this is Lila Begin," Ortega said formally. "Ms. Begin, this is Takashi Kovacs, Lorenz Bancroft's retained investigator." The large eyes appraised me frankly.
"You're from off-world?" she asked me.
"That's correct. Harlan's world."
"Yes, the lieutenant mentioned it."
There was a well-designed huskiness to Lila Begin's voice, and an accent that suggested she was unused to speaking Amanglik.
"I can only hope that means you have an open mind."
"Open to what?"
"The truth." Begin gave me a surprised look. "Lieutenant Ortega tells me you are interested in the truth. Shall we walk?"
Without waiting for a response, she set off parallel with the surf. I exchanged a glance with Ortega, who gestured with her thumb but showed no signs of moving herself. I hesitated for a couple of moments, then went after Begin. "What's all this about the truth?" I asked, catching her up.
"You have been retained to discover who killed Lorenz Bancroft," she said intensely, without looking around. "You wish to know the truth of what transpired the night he died. Is this not so?"
"You don't think it was suicide, then?"
"Do you?"
I asked first.
I saw a faint smile across her lips. "No, I don't."
"Let me guess. You're pinning it on Miriam Bancroft." Lila Begin stopped and turned on one of her ornate heels.
"Are you mocking me, Mr. Kovacs?"
There was something in her eyes that drained the irritable amusement out of me on the spot. I shook my head. "No, I'm not mocking you. But I'm right, aren't I?"
"Have you met Miriam Bancroft?"
"Briefly, yes."
"You found her charming, no doubt."
I shrugged evasively. "A bit abrasive at times, but generally, yes, charming would do it."
Begin looked me in the eyes. She is a psychopath, she said seriously.
She resumed walking. After a moment, I followed her. Psychopath's not a narrow term anymore, I said carefully. I've heard it applied to whole cultures on occasion. It's even been applied to me once or twice. Reality is so flexible these days, it's hard to tell who's disconnected from it and who isn't. You might even say it's a pointless distinction.
Mr. Kovach,
there was an impatient note in the woman's voice now.
Miriam Bancroft assaulted me when I was pregnant and murdered my unborn child. She was aware that I was pregnant. She acted with intention. Have you ever been 7 months pregnant?
I shook my head. No.
That is too bad. It's an experience we should all be required to go through at least once.
Kind of hard to legislate.
Bagan looked at me sidelong. In that sleeve, you look like a man acquainted with loss, but that's the surface. Are you what you appear, Mr. Kovach? Are you acquainted with loss? Irretrievable loss we're discussing. Are you acquainted with that?
I think so, I said, more stiffly than I'd intended.
Then you will understand my feelings about Miriam Bancroft. On Earth, cortical stacks are fitted after birth.
Where I come from, too.
I lost that child. No amount of technology will bring it back.
I couldn't tell if the rising tide of emotion in Lila Bagan's voice was real or contrived, but I was losing focus. I cut back to start. That doesn't give Miriam Bancroft a motive for killing her husband.
Of course it does.
Bagan favored me with a sidelong glance again, and there was another bitter smile on her face.
I was not an isolated incident in Lorenz Bancroft's life. How do you think he met me?
In Oakland, I heard. The smile blossomed into a hard laugh.
Very euphemistic. Yes, he certainly met me in Oakland. He met me on what they used to call the meat rack. Not a very classy place. Lorenz needed to degrade Mr. Kovach. That's what made him hard. He'd been doing it for decades before me, and I don't see why he would have stopped afterwards.
So Miriam decides, suddenly, enough's enough, and ventilates him?
She's capable of it.
I'm sure she is. Bagan's theory was as full of holes as a captured Sharian deserter, but I wasn't about to elaborate the details of what I knew to this woman. You harbor no feelings about Bancroft himself, I suppose? Good or bad? The smile again.
I was a whore, Mr. Kovach. A good one. A good whore feels what the client wants her to feel. There's no room for anything else.
You telling me you can shut your feelings down just like that?
You telling me you can't?
She retorted. All right. What did Lorenz Bancroft want you to feel? She stopped and faced me slowly. I felt uncomfortably as if I had just slapped her. Her face had gone mask-like with remembrance.
Animal abandonment, she said finally. And then abject gratitude. And I stopped feeling them both as soon as he stopped paying me.
And what do you feel now?
Now.
Lila Bagan looked out to sea as if testing the temperature of the breeze against what was inside her.
Now I feel nothing, Mr. Kovach.
You agreed to talk to me. You must have had a reason. Bagan made a dismissive gesture.
The lieutenant asked me to.
Very public-spirited of you. The woman's gaze came back to me.
You know what happened after my miscarriage?
I heard you were paid off.
Yes. Unpleasant sounding, isn't it? But that's what happened. I took Bancroft's money and I shut up. It was a lot of money. But I didn't forget where I came from. I still get back to Oakland 2 or 3 times a year. I know the girls who work the rack now. Lieutenant Ortega has a good name there. Many of the girls owe her. You might say I am paying off some favors.
And revenge on Miriam Bancroft doesn't come into it?
What revenge?
Lila Biggin laughed her hard little laugh again.
I am giving you information because the lieutenant has asked me to. You won't be able to do anything to Miriam Bancroft. She is a meth. She is untouchable.
No one's untouchable. Not even meths. Biggin looked at me sadly.
You are not from here,
she said.
And it shows.
Biggin's call had been routed through a Caribbean linkage broker, and the virtual time rented out of a Chinatown forum provider. Cheap, Ortega told me on the way in, and probably as secure as anywhere. Bancroft wants privacy, he spends $500,000 on discretion systems. Me? I just go talk when no one's listening. It was also cramped. Slotted in between a pagoda-shaped bank and a steamy windowed restaurant frontage, space was at a premium. The reception area was reached by filing up a narrow steel staircase and along a gantry pinned to one wing of the pagoda's middle tier. A lavish 7 or 8 square meters of fused sand flooring under a cheap glass view dome provided prospective clients with a waiting area, natural light, and 2 pairs of seats that looked as if they had been torn out of a decommissioned jetliner. Adjacent to the seats, an ancient Asian woman sat behind a battery of secretarial equipment, most of which appeared to be switched off, and guarded a flight of access steps into the bowels of the building. Down below, it was all hairpin corridors racked with cable conduits and piping. Each length of corridor was lined with the doors of the service cubicles. The trode couches were set into the cubicles at a sharp upright angle to economize on floor space and surrounded on all sides by blinking, dusty-faced instrument panels. You strapped yourself in, troded up, and then tapped the code number given to you at reception into the arm of the couch. Then the machine came and got your mind. Returning from the wide-open horizon of the beach virtuality was a shock. Opening my eyes on the banks of instrumentation just above my head, I suffered a momentary flashback to Harlan's world. 13 years old and waking up in a virtual arcade after my first porn format. A low-ratio forum where 2 minutes of real-time got me an experiential hour and a half in the company of 2 pneumatically breasted playmates whose bodies bore more resemblance to cartoons than real women. The scenario had been a candy-scented room of pink cushions and fake fur rugs, with windows that gave poor resolution onto a nighttime cityscape. When I started running with the gangs and making more money, the ratio and resolution went up, and the scenarios got more imaginative. But the thing that never changed was the stale smell and the tackiness of the trodes on your skin when you surfaced afterwards between the cramped walls of the coffin. Kovac? I blinked and reached for the straps. Shouldering my way out of the cubicle, I found Ortega already waiting in the pipeline corridor.
So what do you think?
I think she's full of shit. I raised my hands to forestall Ortega's outburst. No, listen, I buy Miriam Bancroft is scary. I've got no argument with that. But there are about 60 reasons why she doesn't fit the bill. Ortega, you polygraphed her, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, I know.
Ortega followed me down the corridor.
But that's what I've been thinking about. You know, she volunteered to take the test. I mean, it's witness mandatory anyway, but she was demanding it practically as soon as I got to the scene. No weeping partner shit, not even a tear. She just slammed into the incident cruiser and asked for the wires.
So?
So I'm thinking about that stuff you pulled with Rutherford. You said if they polygraphed you while you were doing that, you wouldn't register. Now,
Ortega, that's envoy conditioning. Pure mind discipline. It's not physical. You can't buy stuff like that off the rack at Sleeve Mart.
Miriam Bancroft wears state-of-the-art Nakamura. They use her face and body to sell the stuff.
Does Nakamura do something that'll beat a police polygraph?
Not officially.
Well, there you...
Don't be so fucking obtuse. You never heard of Custom Biochem?
I paused at the foot of the stairs up to reception and shook my head. I don't buy it. Torture husband with a weapon only she and he have access to? No one's that stupid. We went upstairs, Ortega at my heels.
Think about it, Kovac. I'm not saying it was premeditated.
And what about the remote storage? It was a pointless crime.
Not saying it was even rational, but you've got to...
Gotta be someone who didn't know.
Fuck! Kovac!
Ortega's voice, up a full octave. We were into the reception zone by now. Still two clients waiting on the left, a man and a woman deep in discussion of a large paper-wrapped package. On the right, a peripheral flicker of crimson where there should have been none. I was looking at blood. The ancient Asian receptionist was dead, throat cut with something that glinted metallic deep within the wound around her neck. Her head rested in a shiny pool of her own blood on the desk in front of her. My hand leapt for the Nemex. Beside me, I heard the snap as Ortega chambered the first slug in her Smith & Wesson. I swung toward the two waiting clients and their paper-wrapped package. Time turned dreamlike. The Neurochem made everything impossibly slow. Separate images drifting to the floor of my vision like autumn leaves. The package had fallen apart. The woman was holding a compact sunjet, the man a machine pistol. I cleared the Nemex and started firing from the hip. The door to the gantry burst open, and another figure stood in the opening, brandishing a pistol in each fist. Beside me, Ortega's Smith & Wesson boomed and blew the new arrival back through the door like a reversed film sequence of his entrance. My first shot ruptured the headrest of the woman's seat, showering her with white padding. The saber light sizzled, the beam went wide. The second slug exploded her head and turned the drifting white flecks red. Ortega yelled in fury. She was still firing. Upward, my peripheral sense told me. Somewhere above us, her shot splintered glass. The machine gunner had struggled to his feet. I registered the bland features of a synth and put a pair of slugs into him. He staggered back against the wall, still raising the gun. I dived for the floor. The dome above our heads smashed inward. Ortega yelled something, and I rolled sideways. A body tumbled bonelessly head over feet onto the ground next to me. The machine pistol cut loose, aimless. Ortega yelled again and flattened herself on the floor. I rolled upright on the lap of the dead woman and shot the synthetic again, three times in rapid succession. The gunfire choked off. Silence. I swung the Nemex left and right, covering the corners of the room and the front door, the jagged edges of the smashed dome above. Nothing. Ortega?
Yeah, fine.
She was sprawled on the other side of the room, propping herself up on one elbow. There was a tightness in her voice that belied her words. I swayed to my feet and made my way across to her, footsteps crunching on broken glass. Where's it hurt? I demanded, crouching to help her sit up.
Shoulder. Fucking bitch got me with a sunjet.
I stowed the Nemex and looked at the wound. The beam had carved a long diagonal furrow across the back of Ortega's jacket and clipped through the left shoulder pad at the top. The meat beneath the pad was cooked, seared down to the bone in a narrow line at the center. Lucky, I said with forced lightness. You hadn't ducked, it would have been your head.
I wasn't ducking. I was fucking falling over.
Good enough. You want to stand up?
What do you think?
Ortega levered herself to her knees on her uninjured arm and then stood. She grimaced at the movement of her jacket against the wound.
Fuck, that stings.
I think that's what the guy in the doorway said. Leaning on me, she turned to stare, eyes centimeters away. I deadpanned it, and the laughter broke across her face like a sunrise. She shook her head.
Jesus, Kovac, you are one sick motherfucker. They teach you to tell post-firefight jokes in the Corps, or is it just you?
I guided her toward the exit. Just me. Come on, let's get you some fresh air. Behind us, there was a sudden flailing sound. I jerked around and saw the synthetic sleeve staggering upright. Its head was smashed and disfigured where my last shot had torn the side of the skull off, and the gun hand was spasmed open at the end of a stiff, blood-streaked right arm. But the other arm was flexing, hand curling into a fist. The synth stumbled against the chair, righted itself, and came toward us, dragging its right leg. I drew the Nemex and pointed it.
"Fight's over," I advised.
The slack face grinned at me. Another halting step. I frowned.
For Christ's sake, Kovach!
Ortega was fumbling for her own weapon.
Get it over with!
I snapped off a shot, and the shell punched the synth backwards onto the glass-strewn floor. It twisted a couple of times, then lay still but breathing sluggishly. As I watched it, fascinated, a gurgling laugh arose from its mouth.
"That's fucking enough!"
it coughed, and laughed again.
"Hey, Kovach, that's fucking enough!"
The words held me in shock for the space of a heartbeat. Then I wheeled and made for the door, dragging Ortega with me.
"What?" "Out! Get the fuck out!"
I thrust her through the door ahead of me and grabbed the railing outside. The dead pistolier lay twisted on the walkway ahead. I shoved Ortega again, and she vaulted the body awkwardly. Slamming the door after me, I followed her at a run. We were almost to the end of the gantry when the dome behind us detonated in a geyser of glass and steel. I distinctly heard the door come off its hinges behind us, and then the blast picked us both up like discarded coats and threw us down the stairs into the street. Chapter 22. The police are more impressive by night. First of all, you've got the flashing lights casting dramatic color into everyone's faces, grim expressions steeped alternately in criminal red and smoky blue. Then there's the sound of the sirens on the night, like an elevator ratcheting down the levels of the city, the crackling voices of the comm sets, somehow brisk and mysterious at the same time, the coming and going of dimly lit bulky figures and snatches of cryptic conversation, the deployed technology of law enforcement for wakened bystanders to gape at, the lack of anything else going on to provide a vacuum backdrop. There can be absolutely nothing to see beyond this, and people will still watch for hours. 9 o'clock on a workday morning, it's a different matter. A couple of cruisers turned up in response to Ortega's call, but their lights and sirens were barely noticeable above the general racket of the city. The uniformed crews strung incident barriers at either end of the street and shepherded customers out of the neighboring businesses, while Ortega persuaded the bank's private security not to arrest me as a possible accessory to the bombing. There was a bounty on terrorists, apparently. A crowd of sorts developed, beyond the almost invisible hazing of the barriers, but it seemed mostly composed of irate pedestrians trying to get past. I sat the whole thing out on the curb opposite, checking over the superficial injuries I'd acquired on my short flight down from the gantry to the street. Mostly it was bruising and abrasions. The shape of the forum provider's reception area had channeled most of the blast directly upward through the roof, and that was the route the bulk of the shrapnel had taken as well. We'd been very lucky. Ortega left the clutch of uniformed officers gathered outside the bank and strode across the street toward me. She had removed her jacket, and there was a long white smear of tissue weld congealing over her shoulder wound. She held her discarded shoulder holster dangling in one hand, and her breasts moved beneath the thin cotton of a white T-shirt that bore the legend, "You have the right to remain silent. Why don't you try it for a while?" She seated herself next to me on the curb. "Forensic wagon's on the way," she said inconsequentially. "You reckon we'll get anything useful out of the wreckage?" I looked at the smoldering ruin of the dome and shook my head. "There'll be bodies, maybe even stacks intact, but those guys were just local street muscle. All they'll tell you is that the synth hired them, probably for half a dozen ampules of tetrameth each." "Yeah, they were kind of sloppy, weren't they?" I felt a smile ghost across my lips.
"Kind of. But then I don't think they were even supposed to get us." "Just keep us busy till your pal blew up, huh?"
"Something like that."
"The way I figure it, the detonator was wired into his vital signs, right? You snuff him, and boom, he takes you with him. Me too. And the cheap hired help."
"And wipes out his own stack and sleeve." I nodded.
"Tidy, isn't it?" "So, what went wrong?"
I rubbed absently at the scar under my eye.
He overestimated me. I was supposed to kill him outright, but I missed. Probably would have killed himself at that stage, but I messed up his arm trying to stop the machine pistol. In my mind's eye, the gun drops from splayed fingers and skitters across the floor. Blew it way out of his reach as well. He must have been lying there, willing himself to die when he heard us leaving. Wonder what make of synth he was using. Whoever it was, they can have an endorsement from me any day of the week, Ortega said cheerfully. Maybe there'll be something left for forensics after all. You know who it was, don't you?
He called you Cov...
It was Cadman. There was a short silence. I watched the smoke curling up from the ruined dome. Ortega breathed in, out.
Cadman's in the store.
Not anymore, he isn't. I glanced sideways at her. You got a cigarette? She passed me the pack wordlessly. I shook one out, fitted it into the corner of my mouth, touched the ignition patch to the end, and drew deeply. The movements happened as one, reflex conditioned over years like a macro of need. I didn't have to consciously do anything. The smoke curling into my lungs was like a breath of the perfume you remember an old lover wearing. He knew me, I exhaled. And he knew his Quellist history, too. That's fucking enough, is what a Quellist gorilla called Iffy Deme said when she died under interrogation during the unsettlement on Harlan's world. She was wired with internal explosives, and she brought the house down. Sound familiar? Now who do we know who can swap Quell quotes like a Millsport native?
He's in the fucking store, Kovach. You can't get someone out of the store without...
Without an AI. With an AI, you can do it. I've seen it done. Corps Command on Adirassian did it with our prisoners of war, like that. I snapped my fingers. Like hooking elephant rays off a spawning reef.
As easy as that?
Ortega said ironically. I sucked down some more smoke and ignored her. You remember when we were in virtual with Cadman? We got that lightning effect across the sky?
Didn't see it. No. Wait, yeah, I thought it was a glitch.
It wasn't. It touched him, reflected in the table. That's when he promised to kill me. I turned toward her and grinned queasily. The memory of Cadman's virtual entity was clear and monstrous. You want to hear a genuine first-generation Harlan's World myth? An off-world fairy story?
Kovach, even with an AI, they'd need...
Want to hear the story? Ortega shrugged, winced, and nodded.
Sure. Can I have my cigarettes back?
I tossed her the pack and waited while she kindled the cigarette. She plumed smoke out across the street.
Go on, then.
Right. Where I come from originally, New Pest, used to be a textile town. There's a plant on Harlan's world called Bellaweed. Grows in the sea and on most shorelines, too. Dry it out, treat it with chemicals, you can make something like cotton from it. During the settlement, New Pest was the Bella Cotton capital of the world. Conditions in the mills were pretty bad even back then, and when the Quellists turned everything upside down, it got worse. The Bella Cotton industry went into decline, and there was massive unemployment, unrelieved poverty, and fuck all the unsettlers could do about it. They were revolutionaries, not economists.
Same old song, huh?
Well, familiar tune, anyway. Some pretty horrible stories came out of the textile slums around that time. Stuff like the threshing sprites, the cannibal of Catano Street.
Ortega drew on her cigarette and widened her eyes.
Charming.
Yeah, well, bad times. So you get the story of Mad Ludmilla, the seamstress. This is one they used to tell kids to make them do their chores and come home before dark. Mad Ludmilla had a failing Bella Cotton mill and three children who never helped her out. They used to stay out late playing the arcades across town and sleep all day. So one day, the story goes, Ludmilla flips out.
She wasn't already mad then?
Nah, just a bit stressed.
You called her Mad Ludmilla?
That's what the story's called.
But if she wasn't mad at the beginning...
Do you want to hear the story or not? Ortega's mouth quirked at the corner. She waved me on with her cigarette. The story goes,
One evening, as her children were getting ready to go out, she spiked their coffee with something. And when they were semi-conscious, but still aware, mind you, she drove them out to Mitchum's Point and threw them into the threshing tanks, one by one. They say you could hear the screams right across the swamp.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the police were suspicious.
Really?
But they couldn't prove anything. A couple of the kids had been into some nasty chemicals. They were jerking around with a local Yakuza. No one was really surprised when they disappeared.
Is there a point to this story?
Yeah. See, Ludmilla got rid of her fucking useless children, but it didn't really help. She still needed someone to man the curing vats, to haul the bellowweed up and down the mill stairs, and she was still broke. So what did she do?
Something gory, I imagine.
I nodded. What she did, she picked the bits of her mangled kids out of the thresher and stitched them into a huge 3-meter-tall carcass. And then, on a night sacred to the dark powers, she invoked a tengu to...
A what?
A tengu. It's sort of a mischief-maker, a demon, I guess you'd call it. She invoked the tengu to animate the carcass, and then she stitched it in.
What, when it wasn't looking?
Ortega, it's a fairy story. She stitched the soul of the tengu inside, but she promised to release it if it served her will 9 years. 9's a sacred number in the Harlanite pantheons, so she was as bound to the agreement as the tengu. Unfortunately...
Ah!
Tengu are not known for their patience, and I don't suppose old Ludmilla was the easiest person to work for, either. One night, not a third of the way through the contract, the tengu turned on her and tore her apart. Some say it was Kashimojin's doing, that she whispered terrible incitements into the tengu's ear at...
Kashimojin?
Kashimojin, the divine protectress of children. It was her revenge on Ludmilla for the death of the children. That's one version. There's another that... I picked up Ortega's mutinous expression out of the corner of my eye and hurried on. Well, anyway, the tengu tore her apart, but in so doing it locked itself into the spell and was condemned to remain imprisoned in the carcass. And now, with the original invoker of the spell dead, and worse still, betrayed, the carcass began to rot, a piece here, a piece there, but irreversibly. And so the tengu was driven to prowling the streets and mills of the textile quarter, looking for fresh meat to replace the rotting portions of its body. It always killed children because the parts it needed to replace were child-sized, but however many times it sewed new flesh to the carcass.
It had learned to sew, then?
Tengu were multi-talented. However many times it replaced itself, after a few days the new portions began to putrefy, and it was driven out once more to hunt. In the quarter, they call it the Patchwork Man. I fell silent. Ortega mouthed a silent O, then slowly exhaled smoke through it. She watched the smoke dissipate, then turned to face me.
Your mother tell you that story?
Father, when I was 5. She looked at the end of her cigarette.
Nice.
No, he wasn't, but that's another story. I stood up and looked down the street to where the crowd was massed at one of the incident barriers. Cadman's out there, and he's out of control. Whoever he was working for, he's working for himself now.
How?
Ortega spread her hands in exasperation.
Okay, an AI could tunnel into the Bay City PD stack, I'll buy that. But we're talking about microsecond intrusion here. Any longer and it'd ring bells from here to Sacramento.
Microseconds all it needed.
But Cadman isn't on stack. They'd need to know when he was being spun, and they'd need a fix. They'd need...
She stopped as she saw it coming. Me, I finished for her. They'd need me.
But you...
I'm going to need some time to sort this out, Ortega. I spun my cigarette into the gutter and grimaced as I tasted the inside of my own mouth. Today... Maybe tomorrow, too. Check the stack. Cadman's gone. If I were you, I'd keep your head down for a while. Ortega pulled a sour face.
You telling me to go undercover in my own city?
Not telling you to do anything. I pulled out the Nemex and ejected the half-spent magazine with actions almost as automatic as the smoking had been. The clip went into my jacket pocket. I'm giving you the state of play. We'll need somewhere to meet. Not the Hendricks. And not anywhere you can be traced to, either. Don't tell me. Just write it down.
I nodded at the crowd beyond the barriers.
Anybody down there with decent implants could have this conversation focused and amped.
Jesus!
She blew out her cheeks.
That's techno-paranoia, Kovach.
Don't tell me that. I used to do this for a living. She thought about it for a moment, then produced a pen and scribbled on the side of the cigarette pack. I fished a fresh magazine from my pocket and jacked it into the Nemex, eyes still scanning the crowd.
There you go.
Ortega tossed me the pack.
That's a discreet destination code. Feed it to any taxi in the Bay Area, and it'll take you there. I'll be there tonight, tomorrow night. After that, it's back to business as usual.
I caught the pack left-handed, glanced briefly at the numbers, and put it away in my jacket. Then I snapped the slide on the Nemex to chamber the first slug and stuffed the pistol back into its holster.
Tell me that when you've checked the stack, I said, and started walking.
Chapter 23. I walked south. Over my head, autocabs wove in and out of the traffic with programmed hyper-efficiency and swooped occasionally to ground level in attempts to stimulate custom. The weather above the traffic flow was on the change, gray cloud cover racing in from the west, and occasional spots of rain hitting my cheek when I looked up. I left the cabs alone.
Go primitive, Virginia Vidara would have said.
With an AI gunning for you, your only hope is to drop out of the electronic plane. Of course, on a battlefield, that's a lot more easily done. Plenty of mud and chaos to hide in. A modern city, unbombed, is a logistical nightmare for this kind of evasion. Every building, every vehicle, every street is jacked into the web, and every transaction you make tags you for the data hounds. I found a battered-looking currency dispenser and replenished my thinning sheaf of plasticized notes from it. Then I backed up two blocks and went east until I found a public phone booth. I searched through my pockets, came up with a card, settled the call trodes in my head, and dialed. There was no image, no sound of connection. This was an internal chip. The voice spoke brusquely out of a blank screen.
Who is this?
You gave me your card, I said, in case of anything major. Well, now it seems there's something pretty fucking major we need to talk about, Doctor. There was an audible click as she swallowed. Just once, and then her voice was there again, level and cool.
We should meet. I assume you don't want to come to the facility.
You assume right. You know the Red Bridge?
The Golden Gate, it's called,
she said dryly.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Be there at 11, northbound highway. Come alone. I cut the connection, redialed.
Bancroft residence, with whom do you wish to speak?
A severely suited woman with a hairstyle reminiscent of Anjan Chandra's pilot cuts arrived on the screen a fraction after she started speaking. Lorenz Bancroft, please.
Mr. Bancroft is in a conference at present.
That made it even easier.
Fine. When he's available, can you tell him Takashi Kovach called? Would you like to speak to Mrs. Bancroft? She has left instructions that...
No, I said rapidly. That won't be necessary. Please tell Mr. Bancroft that I shall be out of contact for a few days, but that I'll call him from Seattle. That's all. I cut the connection and checked my watch. There was about an hour and 40 minutes left of the time I'd given myself to be on the bridge. I went looking for a bar. I'm stacked, backed up, and I'm Fifth Dan. And I'm not afraid of the Patchwork Man. The small coin of urchin rhyme gleamed up at me from the silted bed of my childhood. But I was afraid. The rain still hadn't set in when we got onto the approach road to the bridge, but the clouds were massing sullenly above, and the windshield was splattered with heavy droplets too few to trigger the truck's wipers. I watched the rust-colored structure looming up ahead through the distortion of the exploded raindrops, and knew I was going to get soaked. There was no traffic on the bridge. The rust-colored suspension towers rose like the bones of some incalculably huge dinosaur above deserted asphalt lanes and side gantries
lined with unidentifiable detritus. "Slow down," I told my companion as we passed under the first tower, and the heavy vehicle braked with uncalled-for force. I glanced sideways. "Take it easy. I told you this is a no-risk gig. I'm just meeting someone." Graf Nicholson gave me a bleary look from the driver's seat, and a breath of stale alcohol came with it.
"Yeah, sure. You hand out this much plastique on drivers every week, right? Just pick them out of Licktown bars for charity?"
I shrugged. "Believe what you want. Just keep your speed down. You can drive as fast as you like after you let me out." Nicholson shook his tangled head.
"This is fucked, man."
"There, standing on the walkway. Drop me there." There was a solitary figure leaning on the rail up ahead, apparently contemplating the view of the bay. Nicholson frowned with concentration and hunched the vastly outsized shoulders for which, presumably, he was named. The battered truck drifted sedately but not quite smoothly across two lanes and came to a bumpy halt beside the right-hand barrier. I jumped down, glanced around for bystanders, saw none, and pulled myself back up on the open door. "All right, now listen. It's going to be at least 2 days till I get to Seattle, maybe three. So you just hole up in the first hotel the city limits data stack has to offer, and you wait for me there. Pay cash, but book in under my name. I'll contact you between 10 and 11 in the morning, so be in the hotel at those times. The rest of the time you can do what you like. I figure I gave you enough cash not to get bored." Graf Nicholson bared his teeth in a knowing leer that made me feel slightly sorry for anyone working in the Seattle leisure industry that week.
"Don't worry about me, man. Old Graf knows how to grab a good time by the titties."
"I'm glad. Just don't get too comfortable. We may need to move it in a hurry."
"Yeah, yeah. What about the rest of the plastique, man?"
"I told you. You'll get paid when we're done."
"And what about if you don't show up in 3 days?
"In that case," I said pleasantly, "I'll be dead. That happens, it'd be better to drop out of sight for a few weeks. They're not going to waste time looking for you. They find me, they'll be happy."
"Man, I don't think I'm..."
"You'll be fine. See you in 3 days." I dropped back to the ground, slammed the truck door, and banged on it twice. The engine rumbled into drive, and Nicholson pulled the truck back out into the middle of the highway. Watching him go, I wondered briefly if he'd actually go to Seattle at all. I'd given him a sizable chunk of credit, after all, and even with a promise of a second payment if he followed instructions, the temptation would still be to double back somewhere up the coast and head straight back to the bar I'd picked him out of. Or he might get jumpy, sitting in the hotel waiting for a knock on the door, and skip before the 3 days were up. I really couldn't blame him for these potential betrayals, since I had no intention of turning up myself. Whatever he did was fine by me. "In systems evasion, you must scramble the enemy's assumptions," Virginia said in my ear. "Run as much interference as you can without breaking pace."
"A friend of yours, Mr. Kovach?"
The doctor had come to the barrier and was watching the car recede.
"Met him in a bar," I said truthfully, climbing over to her side and making for the rail.
It was the same view I'd seen when Curtis brought me back from Suntouch House the day of my arrival. In the gloomy, pre-rain light, the aerial traffic glimmered above the buildings across the bay like a swarm of fireflies. Narrowing my eyes, I could make out detail on the island of Alcatraz, the gray-walled and orange-windowed bunker of Psychosec S.A. Beyond lay Oakland. At my back, the open sea, and to north and south a solid kilometer of empty bridge. Reasonably sure that nothing sort of tactical artillery could surprise me here, I turned back to look at the doctor. She seemed to flinch as my gaze fell on her.
"What's the matter?"
I asked softly. "Medical ethics pinching a little?"
"It was not my idea."
"I know that. You just signed the releases, turned a blind eye, that kind of thing. So who was it?"
"I don't know," she said, not quite steady. "Someone came to see Sullivan. An artificial sleeve. Asian, I think."
I nodded. Trep.
"What were Sullivan's instructions?"
"Virtual net locator, fitted between the cortical stack and neural interface."
The clinical details seemed to give her strength. Her voice firmed up.
We did the surgery 2 days before you were freighted. Microscalpeled into the vertebrae along the line of the original stack incision, and plugged it with graft tissue. No show under any kind of sweep outside virtual. You'd have to run a full neuroelectrical to find it. How did you guess?
I didn't have to guess. Someone used it to locate and lever a contract killer out of the Bay City Police holding stack. That's aiding and abetting. You and Sullivan are both going down for a couple of decades minimum. She looked pointedly up and down the empty bridge.
In that case, why aren't the police here, Mr. Kovac?
I thought about the rap sheet and military records that must have come to Earth with me, and what it must feel like standing here alone with someone who had done all those things. What it must have taken to come out here alone. Slowly, a reluctant smile crept out of one corner of my mouth. All right, I'm impressed, I said. Now tell me how to neutralize the damn thing. She looked at me seriously, and the rain began to fall. Heavy drops, dampening the shoulders of her coat. I felt it in my hair. We both glanced up, and I cursed. A moment later, she stepped closer to me and touched a heavy brooch on one wing of her coat. The air above us shimmered, and the rain stopped falling on me. Looking up again, I saw it exploding off the dome of the repulsion field over our heads. Around our feet, the paving darkened in splotches and then uniformly, but a magic circle around our feet stayed dry.
To actually remove the locator will require microsurgery similar to its placement. It can be done, but not without a full micro-op theater. Anything less, and you run the risk of damaging the neural interface, or even the spinal nerve canals.
I shifted a little, uncomfortable at our proximity. Yeah, I figured.
Well, then, you've probably also figured, she said, burlesquing my accent, that you can enter either a scrambling signal or a mirror code into the stack receiver to neutralize the broadcast signature.
If you've got the original signature.
If, as you say, you have the original signature.
She reached into her pocket and produced a small, plastic-sheathed disc, waited in her palm for a moment, and then held it out to me.
Well, now you have.
I took the disc and looked at it speculatively.
It's genuine. Any neuroelectrical clinic will confirm that for you. If you have doubts, I can recommend...
Why are you doing this for me?
She met my eye without flinching this time. I'm not doing it for you, Mr. Kovac. I am doing this for myself.
I waited. She looked away for a moment across the bay.
I am not a stranger to corruption, Mr. Kovac. No one can work for long in a justice facility and fail to recognize a gangster. The synthetic was one of a type. Warden Sullivan has had dealings with these people as long as I have had tenure at Bay City. Police jurisdiction ends outside our doors, and administration salaries are not high.
She looked back at me.
I have never taken payment from these people, nor, until now, had I acted on their behalf. But equally, I have never stood against them. It has been very easy to bury myself in my work and pretend not to see what goes on.
The human eye is a wonderful device, I quoted from poems and other prevarications absently. With a little effort, it can fail to see even the most glaring injustice.
Very aptly put.
It's not mine. So how come you did the surgery? She nodded.
As I said, until now I had managed to avoid actual contact with these people. Sullivan had me assigned to off-world sleeving because there wasn't much of it, and the favors he did were all local. It made it easier for both of us. He's a good manager in that respect.
Shame I came along, then.
Yes, it presented a problem. He knew it'd look odd if I was taken off the procedure for one of his more compliant medics, and he didn't want any waves. Apparently, this was something big.
She placed the same derisive stress on the words as she had on my figure earlier.
These people were jacked in at high level, and everything had to be smooth, but he wasn't stupid. He had a rationale all ready for me.
Which was? She gave me another candid look.
That you were a dangerous psychopath, a killing machine turned rabid, and that, whatever the reasons, it wouldn't be a good idea to have you swimming the data flows untagged. No telling where you could needle cast to once you're out of the real world. And I bought it. He showed me the files they have on you. Oh, he wasn't stupid. No, I was.
I thought of Lila Bagan and our talk of psychopaths on the virtual beach, of my own flippant responses. Sullivan wouldn't be the first person to call me a psychopath, and you wouldn't be the first person to buy it either. The envoys, well, it's... I shrugged and looked away. It's a label. Simplification for public consumption.
They say a lot of you turned. That 20% of the serious crime in the Protectorate is caused by renegade envoys. Is it true?
The percentage? I stared away through the rain. I wouldn't know. There are a lot of us out there, yes. There's not much else to do once you've been discharged from the Corps. They won't let you into anything that might lead to a position of power or influence. On most worlds, you're barred from holding public office. Nobody trusts envoys, and that means no promotion, no prospects. No loans, no credit. I turned back to her. And the stuff we've been trained to do is so close to crime, there's almost no difference. Except that crime is easier. Most criminals are stupid. You probably know that. Even the organized syndicates are like kid gangs compared to the Corps. It's easy to get respect. And when you've spent the last decade of your life jacking in and out of sleeves, cooling out on stack and living virtual, the threats that law enforcement has to offer are pretty bland. We stood together in silence for a while.
I'm sorry, she said finally.
Don't be. Anyone reading those files on me would have...
That isn't what I meant.
Oh. I looked down at the disc in my hands. Well, if you were looking to atone for something, I'd say you just have. And take it from me, no one stays totally clean. The only place you get to do that is on stack.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, well, there's just one more thing I'd like to know.
Yes?
Is Sullivan at Bay City Central right now?
He was when I went out.
And what time is he likely to leave this evening?
It's usually around 7.
She compressed her lips.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to ask him some questions, I said truthfully.
And if he won't answer them?
Like you said, he's not stupid. I put the disc into my jacket pocket. Thank you for your help, Doctor. I'd suggest you try not to be around the facility at 7 tonight. And thank you.
As I said, Mr. Kovach, I am doing this for myself.
That's not what I meant, Doctor.
Oh.
I placed one hand lightly on her arm, then stepped away from her, and so back out into the rain. Chapter 24. The wood of the bench had been worn by decades of occupants into a series of comfortable buttock-shaped depressions, and the arms were similarly sculpted. I molded myself lengthwise into the curves, cocked my boots on the bench end nearest the doors I was watching, and settled down to read the graffiti etched into the wood. I was soaked from the long walk back across town, but the hall was pleasantly heated, and the rain rattled impotently on the long transparent panels of the tilted roof high above my head. After a while, one of the dog-sized cleaning robots came to wipe away my muddy footprints from the fused glass paving. I watched it idly until the job was done, and the record of my arrival on the bench was totally erased. It would have been nice to think my electronic traces could be wiped in the same way. But that kind of escape belonged to the legendary heroes of another age. The cleaning robot trundled off, and I went back to the graffiti. Most of it was Amanglic or Spanish, old jokes that I'd seen before in 100 similar places. Cabron modificado, and absent without sleeve. The old crack, the altered native, was here. But high on the bench's backrest and chiseled upside down, like a tiny pool of inverted calm in all the rage and desperate pride, I found a curious haiku in kanji. Pull on the new flesh like borrowed gloves, and burn your fingers once again. The author must have been hanging over the back of the bench when he cut it into the wood, but still each character was executed with elegant care. I gazed at the calligraphy for what was probably a long time, while memories of Harlan's world sang in my head like high-tension cables. A sudden burst of crying over to my right jolted me out of the reverie. A young black woman and her two children, also black, were staring at the stooped, middle-aged white man standing before them in tattered UN surplus fatigues. Family reunion. The young woman's face was a mask of shock. It hadn't hit her properly yet, and the smaller child, probably no more than four, just didn't get it at all. She was looking right through the white man, mouth forming the repeated question, "Where's Daddy? Where's Daddy?" The man's features were glistening in the rainy light from the roof. He looked like he'd been crying since they dragged him out of the tank. I rolled my head to an empty quadrant of the hall. My own father had walked right past his waiting family and out of their lives when he was reslaved. We never even knew which one he was, although I sometimes wonder if my mother didn't catch some splinter of recognition in an averted gaze, some echo of stance or gait as he passed. I don't know if he was too ashamed to confront us, or more likely too set up with the luck of drawing a sleeve sounder than his own alcohol-wrecked body had been, and already plotting a new course for other cities and younger women. I was 10 at the time. The first I knew about it was when the attendants ushered us out of the facility just short of locking up for the night. We'd been there since noon. The chief attendant was an old man, conciliatory and very good with kids. He put his hand on my shoulder and spoke kindly to me before leading us out. To my mother, he made a short bow and murmured something formal that allowed her to keep the dam of her self-control intact. He probably saw a few like us every week. I memorized Ortega's discrete destination code for something to do with my mind, then shredded that panel of the cigarette pack and ate it. My clothes were almost dried through by the time Sullivan came through the doors leading out of the facility and started down the steps. His thin frame was cloaked in a long gray raincoat, and he wore a brimmed hat, something I hadn't seen any of so far in Bay City. Framed in the V between my propped feet and reeled into close-up with a Nurochem, his face looked pale and tired. I shifted a little on the bench and brushed the holstered Phillips gun with the tips of my fingers. Sullivan was coming straight toward me, but when he saw my form sprawled on the bench, he pursed his mouth with disapproval and altered course to avoid what he presumably took for a derelict cluttering up the facility. He passed without giving me another glance. I gave him a few meters start and then swung silently to my feet and went after him, slipping the Phillips gun out of its holster under my coat. I caught up just as he reached the exit. As the doors parted for him, I shoved him rudely in the small of the back and stepped quickly outside in his wake. He was swinging back to face me, features contorted with anger as the doors started to close.
"What do you think you're—"
The rest of it died on his lips as he saw who I was. "Warden Sullivan," I said affably, and showed him the Phillips gun under my jacket. "This is a silent weapon, and I'm not in a good mood. Please do exactly as I tell you." He swallowed.
"What do you want?"
"I want to talk about Trap, among others, and I don't want to do it in the rain. Let's go."
"My car is—"
"A really bad idea," I nodded. "So let's walk. And, Warden Sullivan, if you so much as blink at the wrong person, I'll shoot you in half. You won't see the gun. No one will. But it'll be there just the same."
"You're making a mistake, Kovacs."
"I don't think so." I tipped my head toward the diminished ranks of parked vehicles in the lot. "Straight through and left into the street. Keep going till I tell you to stop." Sullivan started to say something else, but I jerked the barrel of the Phillips gun at him and he shut up. Sideways at first, he made his way down the steps to the parking lot and then, with occasional backward glances, across the uneven ground toward the sagging double gate that had rusted open on its runners what looked like centuries ago.
"Eyes front," I called across the widening gap between us. "I'm still back here. You don't need to worry about that."
Out on the street, I let the gap grow to about a dozen meters and pretended complete disassociation from the figure ahead of me. It wasn't a great neighborhood, and there weren't many people out walking in the rain, Sullivan was an easy target for the Phillips gun at double the distance. 5 blocks on, I spotted the steamed-up windows of the noodle house I was looking for. I quickened my pace and came up on Sullivan's street-side shoulder.